It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll find out why planting prairies in farm areas can have a big environmental benefit.
First, overcrowding in Wisconsin's prisons has become an issue in recent years, and action might need to be taken sooner rather than later. Addressing lawmakers yesterday, Department of Corrections Secretary John Litcher says Wisconsin needs more prison space by the year 2020, maybe even sooner.
The state prison population has grown significantly over the last 25 years and is expected to continue growing. Litcher says the prison population has increased by 700 inmates since he took the job in March of last year.
Molly Beck joins us now. She's a state capitol reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal, and she's been covering this story. Molly, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me again.
So as we mentioned, DOC Secretary John Litcher addressed lawmakers yesterday about the state's prison overcrowding problem. Can you tell us more about what he had to say?
Yeah, Secretary John Litcher, he basically said that the prisons in the state are at capacity right now. So there's about 23,000 inmates. That number fluctuates day to day, but right now they need more space, and the legislature and state officials are convening this committee to look at the longer range planning of the prison system's infrastructure. And part of that is, you know, whether to build a new prison or expand current prisons and maybe even close down prisons. He said that, you know, before 2020, they're going to need more space and some relief because it's at capacity at the moment.
And you point out that the state's prison population has more than tripled over the last 25 years. It's not increasing as quickly as it had, but do we have a sense as to the causes behind that?
Yeah, it rose significantly between 1990 and 2000, and a lot of that is due to some tough drug crime legislation that sent drug offenders into the prison system in rates that they hadn't before. Since then, it hasn't grown as much. I think in 1990, we had about 7,000 inmates in the prison system, and it grew to about 20,000 by 2000. But since then, we have about 3,000 more inmates than we did in 2000. Part of that is last year, legislature increased penalties for drunken driving, and at the time, they knew that would, you know, increase the prison population, which had been a reason they hadn't done so up until then. So, you know, increasing penalties for some of these crimes that are more common than others are a big reason why the prison population grows.
So let's get into some of the solutions they're talking about. You mentioned some of the ideas for increasing capacity. What are there concrete proposals that lawmakers and the DOC are looking at to give more cells, whether that's new buildings or adding on to current prisons?
Yeah, there's not a concrete strategy or, you know, comprehensive plan about addressing the full prison system and how they're going to manage the population. But there is one bill that's going through the legislature right now that would basically result in a new Green Bay prison. The prison there right now is overcrowded, and it's very old. It's over 100 years old. And this bill would allow a private contractor to build a new prison and lease it to the state, essentially. Other things that they could look at, Secretary Litcher said, is to expand current prison facilities. He said when they were built, they had expansion in mind, and they may have space there to add some buildings.
Talking to Molly Beck, reporter at the Wisconsin State Journal, looking at prisons in Wisconsin, prisons approaching capacity. State lawmakers and the Department of Corrections talking about expanding that capacity. That's one possible solution, Molly. You also talk about Democratic State Senator Bob Wirch and others saying we should maybe be considering reforms to send fewer people to prison in the first place. What kinds of things are they talking about?
Right. Yeah, there's a lot of discussion, especially among Democratic lawmakers, about how to address, you know, these offenders before they even get to the prison system. And some of those solutions could be expanding drug courts, which are a way to kind of rehabilitate those who are addicted to drugs and are repeat offenders and would not, you know, that would result in jail time and some, you know, education and just a way to keep them out of the prison, but still addressing you know, the issue that they have. There's also substance abuse counseling, things like that, that can kind of help with the nonviolent crimes that still result in, sometimes result in prison time.
And did Secretary Litcher say anything about what happens if we just go with the status quo and don't reduce the number of prisoners or increase the capacity of prisons?
Yeah, he didn't really address that yesterday, but I know that the state sometimes contracts with counties, and if they need space in county jails, they'll use that. That's one way that they have kind of a stopgap measure to alleviate some crowding.
I want to move on to a related issue you've been reporting on, the Lincoln Hills Youth Prison Correctional Facility. In the news again, there's been a lot going on there. Changes, judges' orders limiting things like restraints, solitary confinement, the use of pepper spray. But there have been some incidents going on there involving staff safety. What's happened there?
Right. Yeah. So this summer, a federal judge who's overseeing one of the several lawsuits that are moving through the courts that are being brought by former and current inmates of the youth prison alleging abuse, he told the youth prison administrators that they cannot continue to keep inmates in solitary confinement for weeks at a time and use pepper spray excessively and keep the inmates in restraints excessively. Staff have said that since then there haven't been effective strategies deployed to replace those practices to keep the facility safe. And so there many staff members are complaining of kind of a more chaotic environment, and they don't feel safe. Some say they fear for their life. There was one incident that I wrote about today that a group of inmates allegedly conspired to electrocute a guard. And when he told his supervisors about it, they didn't call the police and they didn't discipline the inmates. And he also wasn't moved immediately away from, you know, the unit where this happened. So right now there's a lot of concerns from staff about if we can't do these things that we have been doing, what are we going to do to replace them to keep us safe? Because right now they say they don't feel safe.
And Corrections Secretary Litcher addressed the situation at Lincoln Hills yesterday, as well as the prison overcrowding issues. What did he have to say about Lincoln Hills?
Yeah, he's maintaining that the facility is safe. I spoke to somebody in this department later after he spoke to reporters, and he said that the secretary had visited the Lincoln Hills facility on Wednesday and talked to staff about some of the concerns that he's heard and ways they can improve safety. So kind of acknowledging that there is an issue that they have to address, but also he does maintain that he believes it's a safe facility.
And we heard in the news that some state lawmakers are writing to the judge you mentioned who had limited the use of things like restraints and pepper spray, hoping that that judge would withdraw that order. Is there any talk of that actually happening?
Right. We haven't heard a response from the judge, the federal judge, James Peterson. But the lawmakers said that they acknowledge that the inmates' constitutional rights must not be violated by, you know, what's going on at the youth prison, but they also, you know, want the judge to acknowledge that the staff has to be safe too. The lawyers who represent the inmates responded to this letter saying that it kind of misses the point. They say that, the lawmakers should be seeking that, you know, the inmates and the staff are safe, and that is the job of the administration, the State Department of Corrections, and not the judges.
Until your reporting, as we start to wrap up, Molly, was there a sense that the course at Lincoln Hills was being righted, if not everything fixed, things were getting better?
Well, I know that I spoke to the secretary a few months ago, and he said, and this, I think this was before the order was handed down, but he said that, you know, a lot of new staff was coming on board. There's a lot of new training. He felt like the atmosphere was changing. There was never, you know, an elimination of these, you know, for years you've heard these concerns from staff. Right now it seems to be concentrated. So I think the department was optimistic, and I know that they have made a number of changes, you know, and as this investigation moves forward.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to Molly Beck from the Wisconsin State Journal. Join us for a look at issues facing Wisconsin's prisons.
Right now, research started in Iowa looks at the possible benefits of prairie plantings in agricultural fields.
The study also looked at what types of native plants were the most beneficial, what effect they would have on issues like soil erosion, and what the financial impacts were as well.
Lisa Schulte Moore is a professor of natural resource ecology and management at Iowa State University. She studies human-landscape interactions in agricultural and forestry settings. Lisa, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
Where did the idea for this project come from?
It actually originated my first semester here at Iowa State University, which was the fall of 2003. And we're looking for ways. I mean, we knew that row crop agriculture here in the Midwest is already great in terms of sort of the production and production efficiency, but also that there are a lot of unintended negative environmental consequences associated with how we produce all those crops. And so it was really generated from the perspective of how can we make what's already good better? And basically, the idea of integrating prairie into crop fields was trying to take what was once this, one of this region's, you know, historically dominant ecosystems, tallgrass prairie, and being really strategic about putting it in crop fields to improve our currently dominant ecosystem in the region, which is row crop agriculture.
Can you really quickly explain what row crops are for those who might not be aware?
Yeah, so here in Iowa, where I'm at, it tends to be corn and soybeans. So, but in other areas, you know, it could be melons. It could be anything that is grown in a row and where the soil is in between the rows is bare, basically.
This integration of prairie and these row crops, where have you tested this out so far?
We originally tested the idea here in Iowa, 12 small corn soybean catchments located in central Iowa. And by small, I mean the areas that we were looking at this were between about one acre and 8 acres in size. We collected some really compelling data, which meant that farmers started coming forward and saying, you know, I like what I'm seeing and I want to try this on my farm. And so now we're working on a suite of over 30 farms across primarily Iowa, but also into Missouri and with partners into Wisconsin and Michigan. And there we're looking at really the commercial production scale. So I think maybe the smallest, you know, field is going to be something around 18, 20 acres. And we're working on some fields that are quite large, like 120 acres in size.
With this method, you know, integrating this prairie system, it seems that now that it's sort of gotten off the ground, no pun intended, it seems that farmers are kind of more eager to integrate this. What does this, you know, look like on just an average farm?
Yeah, basically what a prairie strip is, it's a narrow strip of perennial plant cover composed of native grasses and forbs. And when we place these, we really are strategic in terms of, you know, establishing them around a hill slope in a crop field or at the base of a hill slope, also considering areas that are already a lower producing on average anyway. And, yeah, planting those strips of prairie within and on the edge of the crop field, one of our goals with this is to basically, you know, when a raindrop falls and it starts moving across the soil surface, we want to be able to intercept and basically treat every single drop of water that's going to be flowing across that field with the idea that we want to, you know, slow the movement of that water down so it's less erosive to the soils on that crop field to begin with. We want that water to infiltrate into the soil and be taken up by the plants and the nutrients that are moving with that water to be used by those plants rather than running off into our waterways. And then sort of a third goal with it, with the native diverse perennials, is providing more habitat for our native wildlife.
So I want to get to the sort of ecological look in just a moment, but what methods are being used right now to prevent soil erosion? This isn't anything new, but what methods are already in place?
Yeah, so I mean, yeah, you're right. I mean, we've been working on the issue of soil erosion since we started farming row crops, basically since we plowed up the prairie in this region. We've been trying to keep soils in place. And, you know, the common method that farmers will use are going to be terraces. Also, another thing that once folks see they're starting to have an erosion problem, they might put in a grass waterway to help armor that soil and keep that soil in place more with the roots in the ground. Other methods, contour buffer strips just composed of non-native perennial grasses. The one that we commonly use here in Iowa is brome. I assume that's also in Wisconsin. If you move further south, they primarily use a plant called fescue. So those are some of the methods. Also, those are vegetative and infrastructural methods, but also changes in the tillage. So farmers will try to reduce the level of the amount of tillage that they would use in their fields to farm their crops to reduce soil erosion.
Lisa Schulte-Moore is a professor of natural resource ecology and management at Iowa State University. She studies human-landscape interactions in agricultural and forestry settings, and she's with us right now to talk about a 10-year-long study that looks at the benefits of integrating strips of prairie land with row crops such as corn and soy. And so throughout this conversation, Lisa, you know, we've been talking about the benefits of how these strips of prairie land can work with farms. We've talked about terraces and how those have been used to alleviate soil erosion. Economically, how does this shake out for farmers?
Basically, if you look at the economics, prairie strips are cheaper than terraces and similar to cover crops in terms of their cost. When we look at it, if you just look at the acre of land that they would convert to prairie, it costs between about $280 and $390 per acre per year. If you look at it on that whole crop field level, because basically we're trying to, you know, protect that whole crop field from the forces of rain and water and keep soil in place, if you would look at it at that scale, the cost would come down to about $28 to $39 per acre per year. And that's assuming that about 10% of the field would go into the actual prairie strip practice. Most of that cost is actually not out-of-pocket cost, but it's associated with that potential for lost crop income. And thus it varies based on what a farmer's expected yields are and what crop prices are going to be. Also, if a farmer or farmland owner is able to get a rental payment through the USDA Conservation Reserve Program on those prairie strip acres, that cost comes down substantially to about $8 per protected acre per year. So while, you know, it's not free, right?
Sure.
It's not one of the more costly practices when it comes to the total cost of agriculture. One more thing I'll mention is we oftentimes get a lot of flack from some folks because in these numbers that I'm providing to you, we aren't actually accounting for the value of that soil or the nutrients to the farm and also the protection of water quality. This is something that we're working on with the economists on the team are working on trying to develop these estimates right now. But those analyses are more complicated, so we need more time to develop those results. So stay tuned on that.
And what kind of prairie plants have you looked at specifically? I know you touched on it a little bit earlier, but what plants have yielded the best sort of outcomes?
Right. So we're looking at a whole prairie community and not really separating it out by species. A few key things about what we've planted and are recommending in our plantings to farmers and farmland owners is that they're going to want a mixture of species, including what we call warm season grasses. Those are grasses that are active during the warmest part of the summer. Cool season grasses, as their name implies, in spring and early summer, they're much more active. And then some component of wildflowers. And we want to have some redundancy, so multiple species of warm season grasses. These would be things like big blue stem and little blue stem, Indian grass, for example. We want multiple species of those because some do better in certain sites and in certain years, multiple of the cool season and multiple of the forbs. With the forbs, what we're trying to do is have something in bloom throughout the entire growing season from early spring into late fall. And that's because part of our motivation with planting these prairie strips is to also be able to better support our pollinator populations. And they need forage, you know, throughout that whole growing season. And so with the prairie strips, we're trying to provide that forage. Now, how many total species? We've sort of targeted something in that 30 species range on most in most of our work. However, some of the farmers that we're working with, they said, you know, pollinators are great, but I'm really just interested in keeping my soil. And in that case, they probably don't need so many species, and they've planted a 15-species mix, which is a lot cheaper. In other cases, we've had farmers that are just like, yeah, I'm super concerned about the pollinators, and I want to encourage as much wild diversity on my farm as possible. And so we've had one farmer actually plant 150 species on his farm.
There seems to be interest from farmers on this. Where do you hope to expand this project next?
Well, one of the things I'm excited about right now is we're actually, because our team, we have had trouble sort of meeting the demand of farmland, farmers and farmland owners in terms of helping them do this. We're right now engaged in a set of trainings to train what we call technical service providers, people that work with farmers to implement practices on farms to actually implement prairie strips the way we have. And so far, 38 other people have gone through these trainings, including 7 in Wisconsin. And now there's groups that are actively, these folks are actively engaging farmers and farmland landowners on implementing prairie strips. A couple of those that are active in Wisconsin include the Sand County Foundation and the Valley Stewardship Network. One thing I'm also excited about is that there's something of a push to install prairie strips on the University of Wisconsin's research and demonstration farms right now. And this will be great because it will make people in your state, for example, come easier for them to come and see and experience, learn about the practice, and see if it really makes sense for their farms.
Well, Lisa, we'll have to leave it there for now. Lisa, thank you so much for joining us today.
You bet. Thanks for the opportunity.
Lisa Schulte Moore is a professor of natural resource ecology and management at Iowa State University. She joined us to talk about the benefits of strips of native prairie land for farms.
First, it's time for Food Friday. If you've enjoyed meals from Middle Eastern, Persian, Greek, Turkish, or North African cuisines, there's a good chance there was some tahini on the table somewhere. In fact, if you've eaten hummus, you've eaten tahini.
Tahini is a paste made from hulled sesame seeds that are toasted and ground up, and it's available in most grocery stores. But of course, if you're motivated to make it from scratch, that's also possible.
One of our in-house foodies here at WPR is music host Lori Skelton. She took tahini for a test drive this month. Lori, welcome back.
Good to be here.
Well, why did you tackle tahini?
I actually have been cooking with it all summer. Back in May, NPR did a feature with three different chefs come up with a dish that you can take to a potluck this summer when you don't know if you're going to have shelf stable or, you know, something safe, something you can leave outside in the heat that's not going to spoil and that everybody's going to like. And one chef came up with a recipe where tahini was blended with garlic oil and miso and a few other things to make a thick paste that was drizzled over grilled cauliflower, served with jalapeno jam and garlic chips. I made it once thinking my boyfriend would try it to please me. We ended up eating it all summer. He now calls it his favorite vegetable. And from there on, somebody gave me salted tahini chocolate chip cookies, which I found utterly incredible. I ended up making a batch of those for the pledge drive this year, and two people told me it was the best chocolate chip cookie they'd ever eaten. So, as you say, I'm used to seeing tahini as a component of certain cuisines, but I've spent the last couple of months realizing that tahini is something that can be added for a really incredible depth of flavor in a lot of different ways.
Well, Lori, can you just, I guess, go a little bit deeper in there? What do you think tahini brings to a dish? You said it's a little bit, gives a deeper flavor, but what else does it bring?
You're certainly going to have an unctuousness to it because of the oil content that's involved. When you're thinking about working with tahini, think about how you'd work with peanut butter. You've got that similar paste to it, although certain tahini can be thinner, and tahini can be thinned with water in a way that is still usable. You try thinning peanut butter and sometimes it just falls apart. And so rather than adding that strong sweetness and peanutty flavor that you'd get with peanut butter, what tahini adds is a depth to a lot of flavors. It for want of a better word, it grounds things. But then again, because it adds creaminess, you can get very, very creative with vegetables or other things added in, blend it in, and come up with sauces or dips or things that don't rely on dairy for the warm, comforting, fatty feeling that end up being incredibly shelf-stable. I made up one tahini dip in August that I'm still picking at. It's perfectly fine.
Wow, okay. That's cruel.
No, it's lovely. It does tend to sit in the refrigerator for a lot longer than anything that's based on cream.
And speaking of sitting in the fridge for a long time, and when I've bought tahini in my life, it's been to make hummus, and I've made some pretty bad hummus over the years. I'm not good at making hummus, but then that's all I know to do with tahini, and that's what reading your preparation, trying the things you've made, it's really versatile.
Incredibly versatile. I was delighted to find out just how many vegetables it does play well with. Yes, we're used to the chickpeas, we're used to anything that's going to show up on a Middle Eastern mise. Falafel is the other one we all know, the fried chickpeas that are dipped in hummus. One of the things that I discovered is that if you're still not on the Brussels sprout bandwagon, if you saute your Brussels sprouts and drizzle a little tahini over them, incredible flavor. And again, you don't need as much oil or butter on that. So once you've got your plate of sprouts, you can get very, very creative with what you drizzle on top. One thing that blew my mind is that it's a really great substitute for mayonnaise in a BLT. It really plays well with tomato and bacon.
Well, as someone who really, really does not like mayonnaise, that's good to hear, because sometimes you don't always want a dry sandwich, just the bread and meat, or maybe you have some water from lettuce. I don't know. But yeah, it's good to think of like a sauce that could also end up on a sandwich. Yeah.
And tahini is a natural pairing with lemon. So you can play around with acids, again, as you're thinking about dips or dressings, lemon juice, lime juice, get creative with your vinegars as well. That's another thing that will jazz up any sandwich.
So we're going to talk about a couple of recipes today. And you know, part of this conversation shows the versatility of tahini. You can use it in savory dishes and in sweet dishes. I guess we'll start with the savory. Can we talk about the savory recipe you've brought today?
Well, the savory recipe is actually one you told
that
me
is
about.
True. I was going to let you have the spotlight here, Lori.
Well, the spotlight really goes to a chef named Yota Motolangi, who was born in Israel, was working with another chef from Palestine when he got to London, and has really become known for bringing the flavors of the Middle East to a lot of different cuisines. And one of the recipes we have on the website is his simple recipe for pui lentils, the French lentils that are a little firmer when they cook up. They don't get quite so mushy. And they're cooked with olive oil and butter and a little bit of cumin and a little bit more garlic and tomatoes, and it talks to itself for about 10 minutes. I ended up making this in our break room and drizzling on a little more olive oil and tahini and lovely slices of raw red onion that not everybody liked. And it's a very simple dish. If you've got the lentils already made ahead of time, it comes together literally in 10 minutes. And it has a rich, warming feel to it, but it's not heavy on your stomach. I can imagine eating this for the rest of the winter. So I'm so thrilled you told me about it.
Yeah, so I mean, this is one of my favorite recipes. I was really glad that you and I had a chance to talk last week, because I didn't know that we were going to be talking about tahini, and that's when I brought up this recipe. And, you know, this is one of my go-to recipes all winter. I almost always have everything on hand, obviously the tahini, because it just lives in your fridge forever.
Yeah.
And so I can pretty much bust that out. I'm like, you know what? This is what I want. And, you know, I take a little bit of a different approach with it, where I caramelize onions and then add it to the dish if you don't want the like hard, red, raw onion taste. And of course, serving it with hard-boiled eggs is just so, so good.
And now I should qualify this. hard-boiled eggs, it's not a 10-minute egg that he serves them with. It's more like what some people call a jammy egg. This is a 7-minute egg that even when you quarter it, it's not runny like a soft-boiled egg, but the yolk isn't quite set. It's one of those things that is showing up more and more in grain bowls. And again, another thing to it's really good with tahini drizzled on top or a dip with tahini drizzled on top. So yeah, go for the not so hard boiled egg. You're adding a little more protein to something that already has a fair amount of protein. I believe tahini has more protein per ounce than peanut butter does.
Talking to WPR's Lori Skelton about cooking with tahini. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your recipes, suggestions, and questions. Let's turn to some dessert right now. And in front of us, we have cups here with ice cream in them and just a little bit of tahini. You put it on top. I kind of stirred mine in it. I never, ever would have thought to do that. It's pretty good.
Apparently, it's standard fare in Israel. And yes, I'd never thought of it. I thought that tahini was just something that was added to savory dishes. I never thought of putting it in anything sweet until, as I say, somebody gave me a batch of salted tahini chocolate chip cookies in June, and they were stunning. I'm looking at other recipes. Again, Yotam Ottolenghi will do a version of oatmeal cookies with tahini. He does a cake with dates and bananas and tahini. And we've got tahini cookies that are on, the recipe is on our website, that I have made regular and gluten-free. They were perfect both times. I've added ginger and orange zest to the recipe. That also worked really, really well. Those tahini cookies we have on the website, I should warn you, I have a tendency to cut back on sugar in a lot of sweet recipes. I just don't like things as sweet as most people. This is one where the texture of the cookies is going to be so delicate, you probably don't want to cut back on the sugar too much. Some texture does require the proper ratio of fat to sugar in a cookie recipe. That said, if you don't mind waiting, I found out by accident that if you accidentally overbake them just a little and then put them in a container and wait to eat them the next day, they get soft on their own and they taste even nuttier and really, really good.
That sounds really, really great.
I do appreciate the fact I have friends who are willing to eat my mistakes and sometimes wait for my mistakes to get better.
So we are going to take Nick's call in Madison. Hi, Nick.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
What did you want to say?
I like to use tahini when making tofu scrambles. It has a richness that is kind of like the yolk of the egg that tofu by itself misses.
That's brilliant. I hadn't even thought of trying it with tofu. How did you come across that? Did somebody suggest it, or you just tried it? You're on your own.
Just experimenting, looking for a better dish.
Okay. And let me guess, you've probably got a lot of green onions in that scramble?
Sometimes. Okay. It's in the fridge. Yep.
Yeah, one of the standard things to play with, if you like peanut butter noodles with soy and ginger and a lot of green onion, tahini, again, lovely, rich flavor, but not as heavy. And yeah, I'm finding tahini and green onions is a magical combination. Wow, thank you.
It's Food Friday, and we're talking to WPR in-house foodie Lori Skelton, and we are talking about cooking with tahini.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Is tahini in your fridge? What do you cook with it? What are your favorite ways to use it? Are you thinking about a dish that might work with it? Do you have questions for Lori about what to do with tahini in your meals, your snacks, and your desserts? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post and find a link to a couple of recipes on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll pick up this conversation in just a bit right here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. Right now, we're continuing our conversation, our Food Friday conversation with Lori Skelton. She experimented with tahini or sesame seed paste, and she's sharing what she's learned.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you use tahini in your cooking? How does it add to the dish you make with it, whether it's a sweet or savory dish? Or do you have questions for Lori about what to do with it, how best to use it? Call in now at 800-642-1234. I had a request to spell it, a great request, T-A-H-I-N-I. Not exactly like it sounds, actually. So
no,
it was a fine request from a listener. Thank you for that. Again, you can call in with your tahini ideas and questions at 800-642-1234 or post and find some recipes on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
So sticking or going back to sort of more savory uses for tahini, how does this work, you know, as a with meat?
With animal protein, my favorite thing to do is use it with chicken. There's a Persian chicken dish with sumac called, I think it's pronounced marmushka, and you serve that with flatbread, and I love tahini on that. You've got this lovely, rich chicken dish, and while the tahini is adding another level of flavor, it's not adding weight, so it still feels like you're eating something light. And something that I found on the allrecipes.com website is something they call the absolute ultimate marinade for chicken, pork, beef, lamb, even salmon, and it's sesame seeds, green onions, a lot of garlic, tahini soy sauce, some white sugar. I actually prefer to use honey when I'm putting this marinade together, some red wine vinegar, and lots of black pepper. You can marinate things for as little as an hour or two, again, with your salmon or your lighter meats. You want to go for overnight, you can have some really amazing flavors, and then from that, you just grill or broil your protein. It's an interesting thing to add to animal protein. Again, it's got a lot of protein in on itself, but it's one of those things when you want to up things just a little bit, but you don't want to go too crazy with extra prep in the kitchen. Just a little bit of tahini can really change the flavor.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Susan is with us in Madison. Susan, hi.
Hi. I like to take the standard peanut butter cookie recipe and use half tahini, half peanut butter, and it gives it a smooth, interesting taste.
Interesting, Susan. Thanks a lot. So not entirely replacing the peanut butter there, Lori, in a peanut butter cookie, 50-50.
Susan, when you're making this, how does it change the consistency of your cookie dough? Do you have to make any other adjustments when you're doing that?
You might have to add a little extra flour to it.
Okay.
Or if you don't, it'll turn out just a little softer, smoother, moister.
And if that's the case, it's just a matter of you let the cookies cool for a little bit longer. You tell yourself 5 more minutes before I start eating them, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Okay, so you have to exercise a little bit of restraint, but it really does work well. But thank you for that. Great idea.
We also have Larry in Whitewater. Hi, Larry.
Good morning. Are you there?
Yes, good. We are. Good morning. When did you get up?
The question I had, I don't know. You've been talking a lot about tahini, and you must make your own like I do. I mean, you must put the sesame seeds in the coffee grinder and just grind them up, or even in the blender, and maybe put a little bit of olive oil, maybe toast them a little, if according to what you're doing with them. And it's always fresh, and it's always sharp.
Okay. Larry, I got to ask, is it really better when it's fresh?
I think it is, yes.
All right. Well, good for you. Making your own tahini, I probably wouldn't do that. Like, I don't make my own peanut butter either. And Lori, I don't think you had tried making your own either, but he makes it sound super easy.
It is easy to do, and if you happen to be in an area that doesn't have tahini always on the grocery shelf, it's showing up more and more and more. But just in case, if you can get a hold of some sesame seeds, yes, go ahead and toast them, and you'll have fresh tahini in a matter of seconds.
And now we are going to go to Nancy in Mazomani. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. I use it in making hummus. I always have. And I know I've had some in the refrigerator for over a year, and I only found that it has a bitter taste. Is there any way to get rid of that bitter taste?
Of course not, because what that is your oil has gone rancid. So, there another reason, if you want to make your own, that you're not going to have that problem. I don't find that the tahini I keep in my refrigerator, that it tends to go bitter. So it may just have sat out just long enough or got too warm at one point that even putting it in the refrigerator, you were putting rancid oil back in. So no, once you've got bitter oil, toss it and start over. It's a pity, but once you learn how to use it, I don't think it's going to be sitting in your refrigerator too much longer. You're going to have a great turnover on this.
Thanks a lot for that call, Nancy. Nathan on Facebook writes, I live here in Eau Claire. One of the Euro shop's owners is Egyptian and serves chicken kebab with tahini. But personally, I absolutely love getting a Euro with tahini instead of the classic cucumber sauce. Interesting.
That would be.
I wouldn't think of that.
Lamb with the garlic. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. That would be lovely and unctuous. And sometimes you don't want the cream to cut through the way mm-hmm. a tzatziki sauce would be with sour cream. If you don't want the sour, you wanted to go more of that warming feel. That would be great with tahini. Absolutely.
Sticking with our Facebook comments, Wendy writes, I love tahini with a little honey spread on toast with raw apples.
Oh, yes.
Which is one of the ways I really like to enjoy tahini, is just kind of plain with honey.
Well, you blend tahini with honey and lighten it a little bit, and then you can fold that into whipped cream and use it to layer between like phyllo pastry that's been baked. Apples are great with that, pears, raspberries. I'm coming back to the sweet end of things. I didn't realize how wonderful tahini plays with chocolate. Have you ever made a molten cake with like a peanut butter center?
I have not.
Okay, molten chocolate cake, you bake it just enough so that the cake is soft, but the middle gets nice and just a little bit runny. Instead of using peanut butter, blend your tahini with mascarpone cream.
Whoa.
Or you can even blend the tahini with chocolate in certain iterations. There are a couple of bakeries out on the East Coast that will blend tahini in with their hot chocolate. You can blend it into brownie batter. You can blend it in, swirl it in cheesecake. And so, yeah, the sweet end of tahini is something that is going to be a lot of fun to play with when you can have heavier desserts this winter. But yes, the honey and fruit, oh, please, yes.
Lori, you've done a lot with tahini over the last couple of few months. Is there something you haven't done yet that's kind of on your tahini agenda?
I'm still not convinced I've found the right pairing of fish with tahini. I mentioned that marinade that will work with salmon. I'm not entirely thrilled with it, so I want to play with that. I guess I'm just not used to marinating my fish. I do see a lot of suggestions for having that tahini blended into, say, your mashed potatoes. If you're making a fish fillet that's sitting on potatoes, adding just a little tahini will, again, add to the flavor but not add to the weight. So maybe that's the way to go. I don't think it's going to work with a fish fry, but I will find the right pairing one of these days.
I'm looking forward to the tahini old fashioned.
Oh, that's on the horizon. You know that's going to be the next thing we
try.
Go
with my tahini fish fry. And JC, you're a big tahini fan.
I do love tahini. It is one of my favorite things. I mean, I used to be a vegan, so getting out of the sort of cream-based sauces, it was very easy to accomplish with tahini instead of veganaise or anything like that.
All right, we'll leave it there. Lori, thank you as always for joining us. I'm going to try something. I don't know what yet, but I'm going to try something. I mean, this ice cream with tahini was good. Not the best thing to eat if you have to talk on the radio, I realize, partway through.
But still, it's a great way to, again, jazz up a plain dish of ice cream without going the full sugar route. It's great.
That's Lori Skelton, WPR music host and in-house foodie here. You can find a couple tahini-themed recipes over on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
this week, the CIA had to fire a trainee on path to take a crucial and dangerous job. Lulu, last name redacted, flunked out of the agency as a bomb detecting dog.
The CIA announced her departure in a series of tweets that caught the hearts and minds of people around the country.
Lulu, for all intents and purposes, she just didn't really care about the job that she was tasked with. That's really what came out of these tweets from the CIA.
Her head was not in the game. I guess they have to make it fun and appealing, or I mean, not just for the dog's sake, but if they're not enjoying it, they're not going to be doing the job very well.
That is true. I mean, I'm one of those people that I saw the series of tweets and was, you know, laughing about it alone in my office. And it was just so cute to see Lulu not doing her job.
Lulu don't care. Lulu is a black lab, lovely dog. But if you want to adopt Lulu, I'm afraid you cannot. The CIA trainer actually adopted Lulu to take into his or her own home.
Yeah,
so Lulu found a home quickly.
Lulu is just living her best life, not doing the job that she was trained to do.
And another black lab has taken Lulu's place in bomb detection school. I can't remember. Chad? Was that the name? I can't remember the name of Lulu's replacement. I saw it and I've forgotten it. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time on the Ideas Network.